Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with successful efforts to suppress the vote ahead of the upcoming midterm elections, particularly in Texas, where the Supreme Court recently upheld a restrictive voter ID law that many consider a poll tax. Jonathan Chait, a writer for New York Magazine, where he has an article, How Conservatives Justify Poll Taxes, joins us to discuss why there is not a constitutional right to vote in the United States and the reasons behind why the Republicans are likely to win the upcoming elections by fair means or foul. Then we will speak with a former veteran CIA officer, Robert Baer, the author of four New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil, the basis of the movie Syriana, which earned George Clooney an Oscar for his portrayal of Robert Baer. Baer is now a national security affairs analyst for CNN, and his latest book just out is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassins. We'll discuss the recent terrorist attacks in Canada and what motivates the attackers, as well as explore the gray area of political assassination, given that Baer himself, while working for the CIA as its top officer in Iraq between the two Iraq wars, was informed by the FBI that he was under investigation for the attempted murder of Saddam Hussein. We will examine the moral complexities of preventing death by killing a Hitler or a Pol Pot, and the current role of drones as America's weapon of choice, which also appear to be a weapon of executive assassination that Baer was accused of, that today presidents can use with impunity in spite of the collateral damage and blowback they cause. And joining us now is Jonathan Chait, who's a writer for the New York Magazine, and he was previously a senior editor at the New Republic and a former assistant editor of the American Prospect. He has an article in New York Magazine, How Conservatives Justify Poll Taxes. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Chait.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And we're less than 2 weeks away from the midterm elections, where the Democrats are expected to lose the Senate. If not, it's going to be a real nail-biter, and it may even go into January of 2015 because two of the southern states, Louisiana and Georgia, have this peculiar runoff requirement. And if the candidates don't get to 50%, then they have to have a second election. In many ways, it sort of smacks of vestiges of Jim Crow, because in runoff elections and off-year elections, the turnout is low, and that seems to be a calculus here. So are we living in a country where we have one party whose job it is to get their people to vote and make sure the other people don't vote, and the other party has a natural majority but somehow can't inspire its people to vote?
Yeah, that is the lay of the land. Now, the big picture is that most of it is things you can't blame the Republicans for. The big picture is that Republican voters are more likely to turn out at the polls all the time whenever there's an election. They go every 2 years for the congressional races, and the Democratic coalition tends to get activated only every 4 years. Now, in addition to that, which again, you can't blame the Republicans for, you can credit their voters for being more organized and more energetic. Now, in addition to that, the Republicans also change the rules of voting to make it more inconvenient, knowing that the less motivated, and in some cases poorer, and in less equipped to handle the bureaucratic hurdles that they throw in the way of voting, that these constituents will be more likely to be weeded out of the process. So this is a deliberate attempt to winnow out the electorate by a couple percentage points, which they know can be decisive in close races.
So when the Supreme Court ruled on overturning the preclearance provision of the Voting Rights Act, and in doing so, John Roberts and the conservative majority said, oh, times have changed, we're over racism, the South doesn't need this kind of punishment or prejudice. They've gotten over racism. And the minute that the Supreme Court acted, suddenly Texas and other states in the South came up with these voter restriction laws. It's hard not to see a cause and effect there. So my question would be then, you're not a psychiatrist, Jonathan Chait, but what's the thinking of these guys on the Supreme Court? Are they acting as agents of the Republican Party, figuring that the demographics are over the long term are against them, and that in order to to be a majority party or to have a chance at winning, we got to do everything we can, unleash the money of plutocrats with Citizens United, and do what we can to suppress the vote of the other side.
Well, I don't know if that's what's going on. If I had to guess, I think it's just a genuine naivete about racial matters that you find on the right. I think I would say most conservatives in America are not guilty of overt racism. I think they're guilty of naivete about the reality of racism. They're guilty of failing to realize the subconscious way in which racism continues to work and continues to influence every facet of American life, and that it's not that racism in modern life is mostly not people saying I will not hire a black person, I refuse to live next door to a black person, but it's more subconscious mechanisms that affect the way we see people who look different from us and make assumptions about them. And I think conservatives don't come to grips with that, aren't aware of that, and discount that as an important factor in American life. And I think that just characterizes the entire conservative approach. And I think that has come into play in the way that they've looked at the voting rights question. They basically say, in the absence of politicians standing up openly promising to stop black people from voting, there's no problem.
Well, I was recently in Australia, Jonathan Chait, where the law of the land is that you get fined if you don't vote.
Right.
And 95%+ of Australians vote in every election, and it has very, very different outcomes. Australia is still, in spite of this throwback, antediluvian throwback of George W. Bush that's just been elected, Tony Abbott, the global warming denier, in spite of that, the country still is a social democracy and a very robust and wealthy one at that. I think you can make a case that the more people vote, the better outcomes for the greater majority of people. And we're in danger of becoming an oligarchy and becoming less and less of a democracy. So how much is this voter suppression in the political DNA of the country itself? I just was listening to a report the other day where they were talking about absentee votes,
mm-hmm.
and how many of them are thrown away routinely in elections because people either forget to sign them or they sign them with a signature that doesn't match the one on record, which comes from the DMV, which sometimes is difficult for people to sign at any rate because it's an electronic form of signing. So these people are perfectly legitimate voters, and millions of votes get thrown away. So it seems to me that the mindset in the electorate, the people who maintain the mechanism of voting, is one of let's throw out all the votes that we have to and basically come down on the side of fraud as opposed to enfranchisement.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would put it slightly different, but I think I agree with you in large measure. We often think of the right to vote and the premise of majority rule as being the essential bedrock of American government. But it's really not. It's a contested idea and has been a contested idea throughout the entirety of American history. And you can go back 50 years, 100 years, and 150 years and find the right and the left arguing about the right to vote and who should have the franchise in many of the same terms that they use today. You can find conservatives arguing 100 years ago that certain categories of people were not fit to vote because they didn't have the same stake, right? They don't own property. They don't have enough wealth. They're too susceptible to demagogic populist appeals. It's not fair to allow them to essentially vote the public treasury into their own pockets, out of the pockets of people who have more money and are therefore better than them. And those same arguments often get voiced today by conservatives. That's sort of what Mitt Romney was getting at in his secretly recorded remarks about the 47% who in his mind pay no taxes and have no responsibility and constitute this nefarious force in American life that he feels almost persecuted by. So I do think that's an important part of conservative thinking about about the electorate that is actually at odds with this very simple idea of democratic legitimacy that many of us think is a kind of consensus.
Again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Chait, who's a writer for New York Magazine. He was previously a senior editor at The New Republic and a former assistant editor of The American Prospect. His latest article at New York Magazine is How Conservatives Justify Poll Taxes. So why is it then that the U.S. does not have a constitutional provision stating that all citizens have a right to vote, only at this point that voting rights cannot be dispensed on the basis of race or gender discrimination?
Right. That's a fantastic question. Matthew Iglesias for Vox wrote a piece in that publication saying we should have a constitutional amendment asserting the right to vote. But of course, the right to vote was never built into the Constitution. The original Electoral College was not designed as a system that was just, to be attached to ratifying the popular vote. The Electoral College was actually supposed to be a substitute for popular voting in many cases. So, and to this day, states are not constitutionally required to let you vote for president. If the legislature of the state of Texas decides that its electoral votes will be determined by the legislature or by any method it picks, flipping a coin, whatever they want to do, they can constitutionally do that. There is no right to vote, and there never has been, and a lot of people don't understand this.
And, of course, recently the U.S. Supreme Court decided that the controversial voter ID law in Texas will be upheld, at least through this November election, even though the trial court testimony was overwhelming and painful at times, where Texans who'd voted for decades were explaining that they couldn't afford this peculiar requirement of a new voter ID, and that that in effect it amounted to a poll tax.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, I think I've written about it as a poll tax, and I think that's exactly the way to think about it. What it is a series of measures that are designed to make voting a little more expensive and more inconvenient on the assumption that this higher burden will discourage some percentage of voters from showing up and that this percentage is more likely to be Democratic. And I think both those assumptions are correct.
And we're talking about, 600,000 people are going to probably be, erased from the rolls?
Well, it all depends on state to state, and the form of these modern poll taxes varies. Voter identification requirements are one of them. In most states, about 85 to 90% of people already have photo identification. So that means 10 to 15% don't. So if you require that identification in order to vote, for that 10 or 15% to vote, you don't just show up and vote. You have to go to some state office. You have to find out where to go. You have to take time off and away from work. You have to arrange transportation, which not everybody has. Maybe you have to arrange childcare. And, of course, if you're a single parent, if you're a wage worker, you have less flexibility in your life, and it's more hassle, and it's probably less and less sensible the more difficult it becomes for you to go show up and obtain these papers in order to do something where you get, of course, no direct benefit. It's just an abstract expression of civic responsibility to vote. It's not like going to get a marriage license or a gun license where you get something tangible in response. Now, the other aspect of these effective poll taxes, I think, is the Republican effort to shut down early voting, because it works in very much the same way. People who have less flexibility in their life have a harder time getting away on a given Tuesday in November if, say, they can't go to their boss and say, I need to work these hours instead of those hours, or I need to step away from the office for a bit. And you can't step away from the office for a bit if you're working in a McDonald's. And if you have small children to take care of, it's harder. And if you have a hard time arranging transportation and so forth, it might be easier for you to find it on multiple other days, or if you can go on a Sunday, which is why Republicans are working in most states where they have the chance to do so to restrict early voting, to make it harder and less convenient, and to weed out those voters who don't have that flexibility.
And arguably going back to the Founding Fathers and the Constitution that decided that voting should be on a Tuesday, which is a work day, that's always been the suspicion that they wanted only white men of property to vote initially. And my understanding is the reason that the states control elections in this country, which has led to this patchwork and hodgepodge of different rules, both at state and county level, is because that was the precondition for the 13 states to join the union in the first place.
That's right. And I think Tuesday was picked because people didn't want to have, some people who were Christian didn't want to have to travel on a Sunday. So the whole process they had in mind was you would spend Monday traveling to the county seat, and then you would cast your vote on Tuesday. But this was all designed for a process which a small percentage of the population would be voting. You wouldn't have, you didn't have this assumption that everyone who was a, who was an adult or even a citizen would be showing up at the polls.
And of course, America in those days was much more a rural country than the urban country it is today.
Right.
So let's talk about your article, Jonathan Chait, in New York Magazine, How Conservatives Justify Poll Taxes. You talk about one of the, I suppose, the friendlier faces of conservatism in terms of the punditry here in the United States, National Review editor Rich Lowry, who's certainly not a, you know, foaming at the mouth Tea Party radical on the right. And he seems to be, you know, maybe it's just the way he looks. He doesn't look like
he's a smart fellow.
Yeah, he doesn't look like a bomb thrower. but yet he's come up with all of these arguments justifying a Republican poll tax.
Yeah, and the one I thought was the most telling was that he compared it, as he used the same comparison that I used previously, which is where I borrowed the comparison. He said, well, look, you need photo identification in order to obtain a wedding license or a gun license or to stay in a hotel. And these are very important rights as well. So do we consider these as being denied to people who lack photo identification? No. So then why shouldn't we deny those? Why shouldn't we require the same things for voting, which like getting married or getting a gun or staying in a hotel is also an important right? What I found interesting about that argument is that it proves a great deal. It proves even more than he thinks, than Rich Lowry thinks it proves, because, of course, you have to spend money to get those things because you get something tangible in response, right? If he thinks having a gun is an important right, we don't distribute guns for free. You have to buy your own gun. You have to pay for a wedding license. You have to pay for a hotel room.
And so to get on a plane, too.
Right. So if you think those rights are on par with voting, why not charge people for voting if you charge people for those other rights? In other words, he's making an argument that would perfectly well justify the direct kind of poll taxes that we used to have in this country before 1964, not just the indirect kinds of poll taxes that Republicans are implementing now.
So have you heard anything back from?
No, I'm waiting to see his response. I'm hoping to have a nice debate.
Well, how about a debate for the whole country, though? I mean, we've got less than 2 weeks to go. You know, you have this perfect storm in the Senate against the Democrats, where you've got Democratic seats up in states that Mitt Romney won.
Yeah.
I mentioned earlier that the outcome may not even be resolved till 2015 in January if the Louisiana and Georgia's Senate races are still unresolved because of the runoff requirement. You've also got these two characters you've got Larry Pressler in South Dakota and the challenger in Kansas, their independence, in effect, they haven't even said who they're going to caucus with. So you could have an amazing situation here where you got a couple of guys in South Dakota and Kansas basically being the center of national attention and being which way the Senate goes and by extension, whether Obama is a lame duck. And then you've got the possibility that the damn thing could go on until January. I mean, it's a bit like Florida in 2000, isn't it?
Well, I don't think it's like Florida in the sense that I don't anticipate an outrage being committed by the voting machinery and by the people who control the process and the legal process. But you know, it is like Florida in the sense of a kind of overtime election to possibly determine control that is very possible if Republicans don't seal the thing up on election day in November.
But just in terms of, just in closing, though, in terms of the wild card nature of it, I mean, the whole idea of elections is you resolve things. You know, you just, it should be categorical, and they shouldn't have all of these complicated side effects that make it just seem like we're a banana republic.
Well, I have to say, on behalf of Georgia, I like the idea of a runoff. Now, I think you could do it better by having an instant runoff election. And now, you know, that's more of an exotic idea that may be too advanced for some people to consider or seem too strange. But, you know, you can on voting day label your preferences 1, 2, 3. But I think the runoff serves a very strong purpose of preventing someone from winning the presidency by plurality, as George W. Bush did in Florida in 2000, right? Ralph Nader took 2.5% of the vote nationally, and so you had a left-of-center majority that nonetheless was defeated. Now, of course, they also had the plurality, but I like the runoff election of preventing spoiler elections from throwing races to candidates who can't get a majority.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you,
Jonathan
Chait.
Again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Chait, who's a writer for New York Magazine. He was previously a senior editor at the New Republic and a former assistant editor of The American Prospect. His latest article at New York Magazine is How Conservatives Justify Poll Taxes. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with a former CIA officer about the Islamic State and the terrorist industrial complex.
You don't need to change.
Oh, give us your vote. Give us your
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Baer, one of the most accomplished agents in CIA history and the winner of the Career Intelligence Medal. He's the author of 4 New York Times bestsellers, including See No Evil, the basis of the acclaimed film Syriana, which earned George Clooney an Oscar for his portrayal of Baer. He is considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and frequently appears on all major news outlets. He writes regularly for Time.com and has contributed to Vanity Fair, The Wall Street Journal, and The Washington Post, and is the current National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN. His latest book just out is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Good to be back, Ian.
And Bob, these incidents in Canada and also in New York as well indicate, at least to me, that there's a lot more to the Islamic State and its sort of arrangement, whatever that is, with followers, both those who show up in Syria and Iraq to fight for them. Obviously, the majority of the fighters are indigenous to the region, but they do have a lot of foreign fighters. And it seems those that can't make it over there are perhaps getting a signal that if you can't join us in the fight in Syria and Iraq, do what you can to go after our enemies wherever you live. Do you have a handle on that possible relationship?
Well, I think it's more sinister than is being reported, in the sense that when you have these 3 attacks against uniformed personnel in Canada and New York City, you know, you can't count on sending a message over the internet and people reacting to it, especially within a week. My suspicion is, well, let me put it this way. In Iraq and Syria, the way ISIS communicates is verbally. They simply send a message to a local commander, give him his instructions, and there's no reporting back. They've gone off cell phones. They've gone off HF radio, all the rest of the things we're so used to collecting intelligence, and they're doing this verbally, and they're also using, when they have to go up on the internet, they're using mobile Wi-Fi, very sophisticated equipment. You know, they drive around, hit a satellite, download a message, and then move on. So they've beaten the National Security Agency and American intelligence. My suspicion is that they actually do have people in this country and Canada who are delivering messages. They can find people, tell them to go for it. I mean, you know, getting people to react on you know, sending some sort of coded message on the internet and really expect them to risk their lives as they have and give up their lives is highly improbable.
Well, given that they apparently, as you mentioned, basically don't use any communications like phones and internet that can be intercepted, and I believe they basically send a guy, like they did in World War II, a courier on a motorcycle to deliver messages. In the case of the Canadian attacks, I did talk to a former member of the CSIS, the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, and a couple of other analysts there as well, and they're all sort of, basically holding back, but it does strike everybody as an extraordinary coincidence that not long after Canada joins the anti-Islamic State alliance, a guy gets right to the Prime Minister's office inside the Parliament at the very moment that the Prime Minister and the MPs are discussing a new anti-terrorism law. I mean, it's a pretty amazing coincidence. On the other hand, of course, he shot a soldier at a war memorial, which doesn't exactly make him inconspicuous.
Well, I mean, there's only so much precision when a one-man attack you can make on Parliament. You know, the fact that he got into the building, whether he knew the Prime Minister was there or not, or his acting irrationally doesn't surprise me. It's the timing of these three attacks, which simply cannot be assured by throwing a message out there to the West, hit Canada, hit the United States. Homeland Security has been telling me for the last year, and these are the rank and file, not the people and bureaucrats in Washington who have a message to deliver, that ISIS is here in the country. I don't know what that means. They, you know, and I hate to align with Perry on this, but they've been coming across the border. They don't know what they're doing, and they've got very suspicious contacts. And this was all sort of poo-pooed, you know, early on, but now that with this attack in New York, that you have the believer attacking four cops, there seems to be some substance to the suspicion on Homeland Security's, you know, the agent's part. So I think what inevitably is going to happen, and this is exactly the word that people at the CIA tell me, that a larger attack is coming in this border, and they put it that same way, inevitable.
So what then is, and by the way, the profile that was done in the New York Times on the Canadian Michael Zahaf Bibeau, it's pretty extraordinary to think that these people can actually be as effective as they are, given their backgrounds. In this case, this fellow was a long-time drug addict, petty criminal. He was even breaking into a mosque in Vancouver to sleep there, and his parents disowned him. And suddenly he gets religion, gets motivated, and pulls off this extraordinary stunt. How do you explain that anomaly?
I think it's just sheer belief and fanaticism. I mean, you know, so like the anarchists in the 19th century, when you're driven by belief, you can kill people, but not with any precision. It's certainly. But this is what they depend upon, is this sense of injustice that's being inflicted upon them. In this case, it's Sunni Islam. And once you identify with Sunni Islam and you're getting bombed by the United States or Canada has allied with you, it doesn't really matter who you attack. You lash out, strike back. And this is what we're seeing. And what we have to face is that in bombing, I mean, ISIS are not good people in any terms, in our terms at least. And they are terrorists because they intend to terrorize us, obviously. But the point is, we have taken sides in a civil war. I just sat down with an Iraqi Sunni who's got family in Mosul, and he says, look, you've got the government in Baghdad. The real army is about 16 different militias, and they are terrorists. So he asked me, why are you supporting the terrorists in Baghdad against the Sunni terrorists? Why? Well, you know, it's a crazy argument, but there is a point to it, is that we allowed this government in Baghdad to be hijacked by Shia militias who were killing Sunnis. And it shouldn't have come as a surprise to anyone that in June they allied the Sunnis with ISIS. I mean, the ISIS are mostly foreigners, but when they came in, they welcomed them, and they are keeping the order in Mosul. So, you know, any time you do get in a civil war in the Middle East, there's blowback in this country, and I think that's what we're seeing. You know, is it going to bring the country down? No. But will there be violence and bloodshed within U.S. borders? Yes.
So, given what you've just said, Robert Baer, it would seem to me that the already bloated terrorist industrial complex is going to be, more money is going to pour into Homeland Security, the CIA, the various intelligence agencies. They don't even know how to spend the money they've got, as far as I can tell. Why don't we...
It's a terrible waste of money. I mean, I've come back to Washington after a couple of years, and you wouldn't believe the wealth that has descended upon this city. You know, places that were burnt out in the 60s from the 68 riots, they are nicer than, you know, Bond Street in London, Fifth Avenue, Beverly Hills, nicer stores, more money than you can believe in the apartments and the property prices. It's clear that the wealth of the United States has flowed into Washington, all thanks to lobbying and contractors and the rest of it. But the point is that huge contracting business didn't foresee that ISIS was going to take over Mosul and establish a state, and that's what they've got. And they have no way to destroy this state. That was completely missed by this bloated, as you put it, but I don't even think that's the word for it, this bureaucracy.
So, but the point I wanted to make was that, you know, we're spending billions and probably trillions on this so-called war on terror, but we don't seem to have a focus on the journeys that these young men take in the case of this Canadian fellow, from being a drug addict to becoming a terrorist. We never seem to focus on the journey, what motivates it, and what drives these people. And, you know, that loosely speaking, from what I've seen, there's a sense, and you mentioned it early, of victimhood, of rage, of a sense that we are being discriminated and history has marginalized us and we're trying to assert ourselves. So why don't we start thinking about the root causes of what motivates the people to join these terrorist groups as opposed to throwing money at them once they've joined?
Because we're locked into this, you know, this business of national security. It's become a business. I mean, there was a time that a congressional committee would sit down and hire some staffers and go talk to these people. I mean, a lot of them are in jail. A lot of them they're accessible, and a lot of people are talking. But they keep on going on about drivel like democracy in Iraq and one man, one vote, and we're going to stick to the Constitution, and no one's going to admit that the war in Iraq's lost or the war in Afghanistan. And no one's, it just doesn't pay. I mean, there are a lot of people in this town in Washington know that, but there are voices that aren't heard because it's being driven by politics and lobbying and this military-industrial complex, which is more interested in filling, you know, filling their pockets than solving a problem. What I can tell you, the last thing that's going to help is if we end up becoming the Air Force for Iran in the Middle East. It's just going to make things worse.
Well, we're in the process of becoming that, at least in Iraq. Ironically, we're doing the opposite in Syria because, you know, although we are helping, ironically, Iran's proxy, the Assad government.
Exactly. I mean, our policy is schizophrenic. It's been schizophrenic ever since 9/11, but no one's really sat down. I mean, right now, the only thing that Capitol Hill cares about and the White House is not admitting that we lost the war in Iraq in 2003. So if we can go through the motions of narrowly defining ISIS as a terrorist group that needs to be destroyed like Al-Qaeda, and then everything's done and we won't have any more problems, simply gets us through the next election. And, you know, we're really looking at 2016. Whether it's Hillary Clinton or another Democrat, they don't want to, you know, be on the record as having lost Iraq and Syria. And never mind that it was Bush that that invaded the country in 2003, because people have forgot. You know, it's political ADD.
So in terms of going back to solving the problem, as opposed to it becoming a gravy train for military contractors, for intelligence contractors, and the other day I spoke with James Risen, who made the point that the intelligence contractors have even got it better in a way than the defense contractors, because at least in the defense contractors have to deliver a turkey like the F-35 aircraft that doesn't do any of the things it's supposed to do, which costs billions, the most expensive weapon system in history. But at least it's a physical thing. Whereas in intelligence, it's all amorphous. They're selling their skills that are undefinable and invisible. Is that what's going on?
Well, no one's held accountable. I mean, there should be hearings on Congress saying, did we miss ISIS's takeover of Mosul? How bad did we miss it? How bad did we? I mean, they let the presidents call up the JV team. You don't ever set up a president like that. Said, don't worry about this, Mr. President. We don't think it exists. It, you know, is a truly coherent organization, and it's not a threat. I mean, once you mislead the president like that, somebody should be held accountable, but nobody ever is.
Except the president. Like, except the president is getting slammed.
Except the president. Right. I mean, he was clearly misled. He wouldn't have made that statement just on his own. He was somebody in the intelligence community told him. And the question is who? And what have they been doing? And if the intelligence community just means signing contracts, you know, for Beltway bandits, and that you pay for PAP and that's what you get.
So is there an example of a more enlightened approach to dealing with militant Islam and extremism, and particularly dealing with that crucial journey from into radical Islam that these young men and women too take? I've spoken at mosques where I've made the point that, you know, that moderate Islam, for want of a better description, is the only way that we can fight this so-called Islamic terror, because a young person who's making this journey into radicalism, the only person, he certainly is not going to listen to a Christian or a Jew, but he will listen, presumably, to another Muslim and somebody that can try and moderate his views and explain to him what the real text and purpose of the Quran is. So the argument then becomes...
It goes deeper than that.
Sorry.
It goes much deeper. You know, it's anything from the fact that Hezbollah has taken over Lebanon, for instance, and there's a bunch of murders in Tripoli. That's a Sunni city in northern Lebanon. It's gone too far. Well, you can't tell the people in Tripoli, Lebanon, don't worry about it. You're now under Hezbollah, the enemy, Shia Muslims. It's gone too far, I think, to go to mosques and turn this around, especially since a lot of this indoctrination occurs over the internet in clerics that are in the Gulf, and they are just, they're meeting a need for people. But I'm not a psychologist. I don't know what would convince somebody who's nominally a Christian to convert to Islam and then quickly move to violence. I mean, I don't understand that. But the organization and the underlying root of Sunni, they're an aggrieved community. I can tell you why they're aggrieved. I mean, you had the Shia Muslims, their Sixers took over Sana'a, the capital of Yemen. This affects people, or the fact we invaded Iraq in 2003 and dispossessed the Sunnis and robbed them of what they thought was theirs. Whether it was or not doesn't matter, but that's what they think. So when ISIS shows up in Anbar province, they welcomed, the locals welcomed with open arms because they were tired of being killed by Shia. It's our refusal to see, you know, their distress and then to cope with it, rather than throwing out that word terrorism, which is just the worst word in the world. I mean, they're terrorizing people, but the fact is, if you leave it at terrorism and say you're a terrorist, we're not going to talk to you, you never do get to the roots of the problem.
But in terms of the Sunni-Shia divide, when you're talking about Sunni victimhood, as you just did, isn't Shiism in many ways based on victimhood, on the assassination of Ali, the usurpation of the religion that it got stolen?
Well, yeah, but that's exactly the problem. It's sort of a Newtonian ethics, you know, action and reaction. Yeah, the Shia have been oppressed, and now they're hitting back at the Sunni. But the problem is that once you step into a civil war, whether it's Northern Ireland or Peru or anywhere, you better understand the terms of the fight before you take sides. Because if you only have a superficial understanding of it, all of a sudden you're going to become the bad guy in it, and you're going to be the center of everybody's hate. And that's what we refuse to do. We discount the lives of our enemies to a degree that we don't understand how to beat them or how to accommodate them.
And, of course, you mentioned Northern Ireland. Is that an example of how long and difficult this road is going to be to end the Sunni-Shia schism? And
exactly. There are grievances there that go back so far back that we don't understand, in feuds and the rest of it. But when an outsider comes in with force, it's no surprise that the locals come back at the outsider. And then tend to blame him more than the enemy in many cases. So then going back to Syria and Iraq, when you bomb Sunni towns, in our terms, it makes perfect sense. These people are bad. They behead people. But we're also touching a vein of discontent that we don't really understand.
We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back and continue the conversation with Robert Baer. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and we're continuing the conversation with Robert Baer, who is considered one of the world's foremost authorities on the Middle East and is currently National Security Affairs Analyst for CNN, and his latest book just out is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassination. And, Bob, in terms of your new book, and of course much of our audience is on the liberal progressive side, and most leftists in the United States think of the CIA as the root of all evil and largely responsible for all that's wrong in the world, when I'm sure, I don't know whether you agree with me, but I think more accurately it's, you know, they're like the guys that couldn't organize a dogfight in a pound, and their power and influence is exaggerated, and you just mentioned that they misled the president and didn't know about ISIS taking over Mosul until it happened. So given that caveat, let me just read the intro on the back of your book that sets up the book, because I think it does a good job. This is what you wrote. I never gave assassination a lot of thought until the morning two button-down FBI agents flashed me their credentials, dryly read me my rights, then even more dryly informed me I was under investigation for the attempted murder of Saddam Hussein. It was of apparent indifference to them that I was a duly sworn federal agent, that Saddam at the time was America's number one enemy, and that I'd been sent to Iraq to get rid of him. I thought about asking the FBI agents to explain the difference between assassinations and aiding a resistance movement organized to depose a sworn enemy. Aren't they both meant to end up in the same place? Before I left for Iraq, I'd asked my boss at the CIA for a definition of assassination. He paused a beat and said, "It's a bullet with a man's name on it." What did that mean, I asked myself. This book is my answer. And, of course, the book that we're talking about is The Perfect Kill, 21 Laws for Assassinations, that we're offering up here today in support of Background Briefing and KPFK. So why is assassination key to so much? I mean, I know the answer, which is, you know, a lot of people say if you would have assassinated Hitler, you would have saved us a lot of grief. So walk us through this tragedy of modern history where individuals seem to have done so much damage to the world, and why assassination is often seen as almost a humane act.
Well, it's a human. I mean, you go back to Thomas Aquinas, and he says it's at peace with natural law that with a tyranny that tyrannicide is permissible. It's the most efficient way to restore, you know, a stable human society. Aristotle, you go right through. I don't think anybody, unless they're a complete pacifist, will say that assassination is never permissible. I mean, I approach it from that. Ideally, if you could remove one person, a cancerous cell, and avoid war, you're better off. War and destruction. Presumably, we'd kill Hitler or the German generals killed him in 1944 or even earlier. We would have saved a lot of lives and destruction. I mean, that's sort of a cliche. If you're a militant rightist in Israel, you could argue that the assassination of Rabin, the prime minister, you know, saved their cause and avoided civil war. That's arguable. But there's all sorts of cases where assassination has actually served the interests of saving lives. I mean, there are people who are cancerous, and removing them is sort of organic to our morality. Pol Pot in Cambodia, you know, and I go right through a list of. Now the question is setting up those circumstances where it actually is a moral act, and it rarely do those circumstances occur. And then secondly, the ability of, you know, a society or a power to take out a world leader and save everybody trouble is almost, you know, it's rare as a black swan. I mean, clearly drone assassinations haven't gotten us anything. If you look at ISIS 2.0 of Al-Qaeda, I mean, you know, you got these guys that headed up the mountains, the tribal areas of Pakistan, and yes, we've broken the back or whatever you want to call it. But what we have in ISIS is a state and a leader in Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi who's infinitely more capable than Al-Qaeda ever was, or their military organization. And maybe we'll find out that they're more, they could be more lethal in this country. So the drone assassinations, you may have made some people feel better for a decade, but they didn't get us anything. What this book is ultimately is an argument against assassination. It is, you know, it's tempting, but it's not an easy way out of a crisis. It doesn't really, it's not really a detour around war. And the circumstances that it would be, like I said, is very rare. And what I had to do in this book is start out with the premise that assassination does work, and then and it's a personal voyage because I was around a lot of political murder, and I when I started the book, I didn't even know the way it was going to start. So I actually chased a protagonist, which we had a sealed arrest warrant on, and we knew that we couldn't grab the guy peacefully, and that you'd end up probably killing him. Call it an assassination, call it whatever you want. But what I go into is just how unqualified we are to do this. You know, I grew up middle class. I don't kill people. You know, you may call a bumbling CIA agent anything you want. It really doesn't matter to me. But how unqualified we are for this. But what I found attractive about writing the book is the narrative is it's a nonfiction book that I'm actually trying to assassinate the protagonist in the book, who himself is an assassin but knows what he's doing. As far as I know, it's the first book that anybody's ever attempted this. I'm not sure how it came out, but anyhow, that's what I tried.
Well, there is this peculiar phenomenon, though, surely, that in the post-Cold War era, every war, not that they rise to the level of World War II or World War I, but every war the U.S. has fought since the end of the Cold War seems to have been against an individual. We invaded Panama to get rid of one guy, Noriega. We invaded Iraq twice to get rid of one guy, Saddam Hussein. We eventually got involved in the Balkans to get rid of one guy, Milosevic. And so it goes on. So what is it about human nature or the way we've organized our societies that one person can be that lethal and the removal of that person could be perceived as solving a problem, which is what happened to you after
all?
Well,
there's a good argument that if you looked at Saddam Hussein, he was a Sunni, but he was so corrupted and so violent and so brutal that he went way beyond the standards of his community, and so did his two sons. And when we went after him in the mid-90s, our assumption was if you could get rid of him and put another general in place, and there were generals that were capable of taking over, you would have saved an invasion of Iraq. Now, this is a huge hypothetical because never got to try, but when I was in Iraq, that was our plan. You know, leave the place untouched, let them move to democracy when they want, put a general in, someone you could deal with. Once Saddam was gone, you put all that bad history behind you, show up with aid, lift the oil embargo and the rest of it, and then we would have saved an invasion in 2003. You know, you're going to say, oh, that looks great on paper, but, you know, well, and fine. That's a good argument, but that any case, that was the intent.
Well, it's certainly a better scenario than what happened by leaps and bounds.
Absolutely. Look, 300,000 people have died, you know, between Afghanistan and Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we went into Afghanistan, I guess, to get rid of bin Laden, and that got us nothing. And we invaded Iraq to get Saddam, and that got us something worse. So removing these two leaders, yes, didn't get us anything. But it's such a great expense. The attractiveness of an assassination is just the sheer efficiency of it. I mean, in biology, there's a thing called apoptosis, where the other cells will attack a cancerous cell and kill it. And that's basically the idea behind it. It's just an efficient use of violence. And it's removing somebody who's an obstacle to stability and progress. And whether we like it or not, there are people like that. In my book, I go into like family stories. There's my family. There's always somebody poisonous, and it's best to avoid them at Thanksgiving and Christmas. I know it sounds trivial, but it's just human nature.
But in your specific case, Bob Baer, you, as I read in the opening, that, you know, two FBI agents come and flash their credentials, read you your rights, and say you're under investigation for the attempted murder of Saddam Hussein. We know that from the Church Commission Committee hearings about CIA abuses that the rules were changed and there was this ban against executive assassinations. And I talked to Mike Scheuer about attempts on bin Laden that could have been done earlier when he was in Afghanistan on a hunting party with a bunch of sheikhs from the princes from the United Arab Emirates, and they had him in the crosshairs of a sniper rifle, but Bill Clinton's White House backed down. My understanding is they backed down because Lockheed Martin was going to lose a contract to sell jets of F-16s to the UAE. So the idea that this barrier was why you got arrested is pretty surreal, given the basic orders. And as you've explained, the generals in Iraq wanted to get rid of this guy and his terrible sons. Did they go after you because the neocons through Chalabi and company really wanted to have a war?
Well, I mean, the assassination is illegal under Executive Order 1233, but I mean that changed. We redefined the word after 9/11. Clearly, going after Al-Awlaki, the American cleric, with a Hellfire missile was an assassination. I don't care who was in the car. And yeah, you can rename as an enemy combatant, but wasn't Saddam an enemy combatant? And we're just wrapped around this word, you know, targeted killing. The Pentagon calls it destroying command nodes. But it does come down to one man, you know, one bullet at the end of the day. You know, we just play around too much with the English language. And in this book, what I'm doing is just saying, all right, this is the way it is. Here's why we're so bad at it. Here's what it should be. And here's why it occasionally works. I mean, this book is an odyssey. And, you know, I try to exclude everything else, like about, you know, military contracting and the rest of it. And I just, you know, going through these 20th century assassinations, it's just, it doesn't get you much. It doesn't serve humanity. And that's really the conclusion of my book. But what I wanted to do on the book and the whole thing is I understand things by engagement. I mean, I understand the CIA not because I keep up with it, but I was engaged in it, and I know the mentality and the way people think, and I know its successes, and I know its failures, and I know the way the left looks at it. And I'm probably to the left of, you know, of a lot of your audience, but that's not the point. The point is I just wanted like a firsthand view, a memoir of somebody who doesn't take himself seriously, but saw some stuff. And, you know, I'm coming back to report what I saw. I just want the reader to go along with the journey. I mean, I joined the CIA as a prank. I'm, you know, you see a lot of hype, best officer. I'm not so sure about that. But what I did was I kept my eyes open and listened and made all sorts of mistakes. And by the end of it, you know, the reader's going to say, this guy's lucky he didn't shoot himself in the foot rather than Saddam Hussein, which I did in a sense, but that's still the point of the whole book. I mean, you have to take political murder and you have to take it out of pure political science and theory and the art of war and go beyond that and look at the reality of it, and then you can make up your own mind. The worst thing to do is approach things like political murder and war and the rest of it from an ideological perspective, and you just... You know, there's a lot of books on how we got misled into Iraq, and I think those are all important. And so I'm just saying, here's how you get misled into thinking that assassination works. But the protagonist of this book, who was considered a terrorist, did understand how to narrowly channel violence and get what he wanted for his community and made it work. But that was a very localized, special, almost in the family sort of thing. It was almost like a mafia, you know, fixing a power, you know, of a dispute, which it doesn't apply to us in as a world power. But for his particular interests of his group, it worked. But that doesn't mean it's a recommendation that we should try to emulate him or that he was right. I mean, in any sense, I'm just saying, all right, here's the 21 rules he followed, and this is why these 21 rules allowed him success. The chances of us or a person or any of us following those 21 rules is zero.
Well, Robert Baer, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.